All right. Thinking about this last week, I started processing this thought of who we are comes before our actions, right? It's kind of like I was thinking, I don't remember the passage that says out of the mouth flows the heart, right? And so basically, like, you know, our words matter and we have a choice in our words, but like essentially our words come out of who we are on the inside. And so I started processing that, writing it, and not really thinking that it was going to be what I was going to share on today, but I feel like it panned out to that. So what I'm going to do is I'm just going to read through what I've written, and I'm going to pause and create space for us to converse about it. And if we have conversations that don't go good on the podcast, then we just won't post it. How about that? Oh, sorry, guys. Okay. You should have come. There's five of us. You should have been here. I'm going to start with the definition because I think that this word trips some people out. I don't necessarily think it trips any of us out, but a mystic. A mystic, as defined by Richard Rohr in one of his meditations a little while back, is simply one who has moved from mere belief or belonging systems to actual inner experience of God. He points at, and I knew this before he pointed at it, but he says it's most represented in the Gospel of John. Out of the four Gospels, the Gospel of John, he's a mystic. Like, he speaks about the deeper things of God, and that's why it kind of feels scattered a little bit, and probably that discourse around chapter 16 that is for like 3-4 chapters all really only happens in a short amount of time. Like he focuses so much on these things that are like, they confuse people, except for like what we were talking when you came in, supposed to draw people into this almost like humble space with God to learn, you know, and to learn the deeper things, you know. I think John points, like, the physical world is meant to represent the spiritual world. It shows it, right? They're connected. They're not completely separate, but the physical world helps us understand the spiritual world. And John is constantly pointing at the spiritual world. It says, Alan Watts wrote, "From the beginning, institutional Christianity has hardly contemplated the possibility that the consciousness of Jesus might be the consciousness of the Christian. That the whole point of the gospel is that everyone may experience union with God in the same way as Jesus himself." Watts also writes, "The truth that religion, to be of any use, must be mystical, has always been denied by the seemingly large number of people, including theologians, who do not know what mysticism is. Its essence is the consciousness of union with God." I think there's a lot of definitions out there and about what a mystic is, but I wanted to say that because I use that term in, and I think it throws some people off. But if I were to have a title for, you know, what we're talking about, being precedes doing. Who we are, what we are, will dictate thoughts, words, and actions. A dog barks, a duck quacks, so forth, right? A pear pears, right? An apple apples. We cannot manipulate this. We cannot change who we are by modifying behavior or by reading a script. But this does not mean we cannot change. In fact, if you look around, you will see that change is inevitable for all of life. This process is often gradual, tricking us into believing that change is not continually taking place. The truth is that none of us, living and breathing, are the same today as we were yesterday. If we accept this reality in the spirit of fear, we will believe we are victims of time and age, and change will be something that takes from us. But if we accept this reality in the spirit of love, we will have hope that we don't have to stay the same, that we can be different, better, more loving, more creative, filled with peace, filled with joy. The hope is that we can and will become more and more like Jesus. That's the point of the gospel, right? Jesus says, follow me. His thing is not just trail after him from a distance. He's asking people to spend time with him, to learn from him. This thought that being comes before doing is not meant to discredit our responsibilities and the actions we take. The way we live, the actions we take, and the words we speak are proof of who we are and the faith we have. James, in his epistle, says faith without action is lifeless. Faith without works is dead. And I think it's funny, I remember reading that there's that small part of James, it almost got kicked out of the Bible because people were so frustrated with the idea, because they wanted to fight tooth and nail, basically, that faith is an internal thing. Except for, if a duck doesn't ever quack, right? Is it really a duck? I mean, so it's kind of like there's this thing of like faith is supposed to be proved by how we live our lives. We're supposed to be a changed person in our growth, you know? It says, and there are modes of thought like that of the Franciscans who believe we are to live our way into new ways of thinking. Truly, if you sit in this, the ideas of both being precedes doing and the importance of our actions do not contradict one another. In fact, both are important, who we are and what we do, both pointing to the other. So it is not being or doing, but being and doing. But where does this kind of change rooted in love, seated with hope, begin? Does anybody have any thoughts? I want to pause on what we're talking about. I kind of like, I know that it probably needs more meat on the bone right now, but... Let me continue. I'll continue. Yeah, sounds good. Okay. All right. Thank you.
You're doing great.
Thanks. For most, when we think of changing, we begin to feel overwhelmed and even defeated at the impossible task set before us. A work that may prove little reward. If you feel this hopeless perspective on change before you, I believe it is because you think you do that you. Sorry. Let me start over. I believe it is because you think you have to do it alone. And be the cause of change for yourself. The truth is, you cannot change yourself. This does not mean you don't have a responsibility in the process, though, because it is also true that for this change of betterment to happen, you must have a yes for it and agree with the process. So the irony is that instead of grasping, clawing, striving, and working toward change, we simply need to agree, let go, surrender, and rest. That's the beauty of the gospel. Jesus invites people, and there are these teachers of the law, these people given great authority, and they continue to lay more laws and more things to do. You have to do this to be this. And he says, my burden, my yoke is easy, my burden is light. Come with me. Share my yoke. And it's different. It's different. The gospel that Jesus preaches is different. It's freeing. It's not more. It's less. So the irony, right? To go and rest. Like, so there's this thought. So I wrote this thing, and Nikki asked when she read it. She says, there's some poetry in there, right? I said, yes, this is one of the poems. Mm-hmm. Before the city awakes, before the giants rise from their slumber, demanding our production, before our lists of to-dos begin, we must simply be. We must listen, be still, rest, and be present. I love that in the creation, there's 7 days, right? 7 days in creation. Man is created on the what day?
Sixth day.
So after that, the seventh day is a day for rest. We in our calendars typically start our work week on Monday. My work week starts Monday. That's the start of my week. The end of my week is typically Sunday. So we typically look like at our work week as though our rest comes at the end. Except for God created man with rest at the beginning. I think that we should think about it that way. Does that make sense?
No, I don't understand.
So there's 7 days in creation, and God creates all these things, you know, the darkness, the light, and then he starts to create animals and plants and all these things, right? Man is created on the sixth day. Mm-hmm. So And then on the seventh day, God calls it a day of rest. God doesn't actually create anything. He just stops what he's done. He sits back, he rests, and he enjoys what he's created. So man's first day in existence, the next day, the seventh day, is a day of rest. So start with rest. It should be, right? I think if we change our thinking, it would be pretty incredible what it would do to our lives. Where does this change or transformation take place or at least begin? In the quiet, in the stillness, where the I am of God is met and the I am of us is set before him. And communion between the two take place. So we're going back to the idea of being who we are and that we can change. In fact, we are changing whether we realize it or not. But are we submitting to a process of change for betterment, or are we just afraid of a process of change and growth and decay and death? Are we stepping into life and change? So where does it begin? I believe in the quiet and the stillness where the I am of God is met and the I am of us is set before him. And communion between the two take place. We are not alone in our efforts. In fact, it is much less about effort than it is about surrender. Surrendering to the very presence of God and his nature and communion with him. This is enough. He is enough. In John 6, Jesus preaches an all-inclusive message that empties the mountainside of his followers. I was thinking about that, and he invites everybody. All-inclusive, right? And we have this thing, all-inclusive, right? Everybody's included. And it's a good thing. It's a cultural thing that Canada is like sweeping. Like, you know, if you watch videos in workplaces and about how we treat each other and all-inclusive language, stuff like that, Jesus speaks to the mountainside, all-inclusive. Everybody come and eat. Except for most. I mean, maybe a few more than the 12 left. Because what he says in verse 56, the one who eats my body and drinks my blood lives in me and I live in him. And me and you, Luke, were talking about probably one of the most offensive things that he says to a mountainside, right?
Yeah.
And John, that's in the Gospel of John, and John is pointing to the spiritual things. You know, he's talking about union. I talked about this a few weeks ago. Last time I taught, I spent some time with this. So I'm going to continue to read. Here, when Jesus says that, he makes it clear shortly after that he is speaking of spiritual matters and not cannibalism. But the offense has already set into the crowd, and it is only his devoted, surrendered disciples that remain. If you are following Jesus, be sure that you will be offended. But if you have the resolve that Peter displays, to where would we go? You will continue to grow in your union with Jesus and will also learn of his deep care and compassion for you and the world. Jesus is speaking of becoming one. Where he calls us to him and we go receiving him, we go to him hungry and desperate. He is the main course. He is the meal set before us. We don't change Jesus, he changes us. We are what we eat. That's what I mentioned like a month ago, right? The whole thing, like, and as we talked about it a couple times, you know, because you asked the question about, like, that doesn't make any sense when he calls himself the bread of life. We say these things, but unless we actually dive deeper into it, I want to be able to talk about it like there is some sense to it, right? There's always going to remain a mystery to us becoming one with God. But, like, we are what we eat. It makes sense, you know? There is much betrothal language in the Bible regarding our relationship to Jesus, becoming one with him, where our identities are no longer that of a separate individual, but one where we haven't an identity apart from him. As though our name is no longer just Aaron or simply Nikki, but Christ's beloved Aaron, or Jesus' beloved Nikki, or the one whom Jesus loves. As you speak about yourself, right? In the Gospel of John, John does not give his name to the reader. Instead, he refers to himself on a number of occasions, six to be exact, as the disciple or the one whom Jesus loved. His identity was and is the Beloved. As you read John and even the other Gospels, watch for the deep intimacy that is portrayed between John and Jesus. It is John who leans upon the breast of Jesus at Peter's prompting during the Last Supper to ask his Lord who his betrayer will be. John seemed to hear the language of Jesus, calling his disciples into marriage or union with him. This is all throughout the Gospels and understood and written about in the epistles too. I think the challenge for our generation with this betrothal language is that we have a hard time separating the idea of sex from marriage, and this muddies the water. The whole of this topic is for another day, but let me say this at least. What? Okay. Sex is simply the physical representation of deep intimacy and connection within a marriage, which is the most sacred relationship between two people. A marriage between two people is meant to draw us into deeper understanding of the relationship God desires to have with us, intimate, deep, devoted, and covenantal. Most, if not all, physical things are meant to help us understand spiritual things. You guys have any thoughts? I think that we... you know, I've talked about this and I really loved it. I remember, I think it was Corey Cummings actually that brought this to light. There's multiple cups at the Last Supper. And we don't understand the multiple cups. And there's one point where Jesus says, I will not drink of this cup until I am with you in my Father's kingdom. That's the last cup. It's the cup they don't drink. Because the cups at the supper represent its proposal language Jesus is using with his disciples. And then there's a consummate cup that happens later. So in their culture, they would drink a cup later when they got married. But when the man showed up to basically propose, they would drink a cup together, but that there was a cup they would drink together later after they were married. It's beautiful betrothal language that Jesus uses with his disciples. And we don't see it because it doesn't talk about sex. Because the connection between us and God has nothing to do with that. Right? And then I think God loves us so much that he did give us sex in marriage. It's like this thing of like, I'm going to let you experience this euphoric thing. It's a gift. It is the mystics that thrive instead of survive in the faith journey. I believe people that don't hold a mystical relationship with God, that are all word, all kind of like rational thinking, right? I think that they can survive. Maybe. But who wants to just survive? That sucks. It sucks to just survive. And to think about like just surviving a faith journey or to just survive being a Christian in your walk, like what a drag. You know what I mean? I just want to survive my marriage. I just want to survive my friendships. But I think without a mystical experience, not just one, but like where you step into that unknowing, that darkness with God, and you experience him, and you feel the breath on the back of your neck. It is the mystics that thrive instead of survive in the faith journey. The rational mind will fail you, for God has established the laws of nature, and yet he is not bound to them. We can see the face of the Creator in his beloved creations. I can see God's might in the mountains, but he is mightier still. I can see his glory in the skies, but even this expanse cannot contain him. Beyond into the galaxies, he shows us that even in darkness, he is light. It is good to grow in knowledge of God, but without love, accepting him in the unknowing first, this growth in knowledge quickly becomes a box that we will strive to build around God. A box built to contain God. How utterly ridiculous and foolish an idea. And I don't think that many, if any, know that this is what they are doing to God in their lives. But if you don't spend time in God's presence, waiting in the mystery, receiving his love, and surrendering yourself to him in love, you are doing this. We do this when we don't spend time with God quietly, just in union. There are things that our hearts must learn that our brains cannot. And it is only until we have received the heart knowledge that we can put words to it. Think about this. When you ask a question of God, are you asking a multiple answer question or an open-ended question? Have you released your need to control God's answer to you? If you haven't, it's likely that you won't hear the answer, or perhaps the answer from God will be a question. Often that's how Jesus responded to people in his time of ministry, with a question. He refused to be manipulated or boxed in. God uses questions to draw us into a deeper relationship with him where trust is built. So if you're unhappy with a question as an answer from God, if you're unhappy with the answer from God, maybe we need to reassess our purpose in talking to, and why we're talking to him. That makes sense? This moment of being present and surrendering is not a one-time thing. Just like our bodies require the intake of food regularly, our spirit, more importantly, requires the intake of Jesus regularly. Salvation is an ongoing lifelong journey where the first step is the beginning of a pilgrimage. I was thinking today about the idea of heart knowledge, right? Something happens in our hearts and we get to put words to it in ways that reveal some of it, like poets, right? They write these things and you can read it and somehow rationally it doesn't make sense, but you can feel. Some people write songs that way. Some people paint paintings that way. Some people build buildings that way. Some people do things outside of what would be considered arts and it touches you that way. I don't understand it, but it's beautiful. And that is deeper than what we understand. And I think that, like, our relationship is God, with God is absolutely 100%. Everything about life points to that, right? So it's like this picture of, like, if me and my wife are all about a rational relationship, we don't ever get to, like, feel our hearts beat. We don't ever get to feel what's good words just like light on our feet because of a kiss, or like if there's not feelings between us that don't 100% make sense, it's dry. And that's surviving. And I really value theologians. I really value intelligent people. I value books that are written so that we can understand the scriptures, and not from a mystical perspective necessarily, but also from a perspective of history and culture and all of that. It's all very important, but that's why our minds need to connect with our hearts, and we need to value the experience with God that cannot be put into words, just like we value the experience that can't be put into words with people we love. If I explain my relationship with my friends away, at the end you're just kind of, you suck the life out of things when you over-explain them, you know? I'm almost done, and we can talk a little bit. I've left some space, so if you have something to say, I gave you opportunities, so don't look at me like that. This is something that it talks, so I'll just read it. Wisdom allows us to hold two or more ideas or truths together in harmony that otherwise would seem to be in contradiction. I've talked about this a few times, such as Jesus calls us his friend, seats us on the thrones of princes and queens, but he does not call us his equal. This is the invitation to meekness, knowing who we are in the light of who God is. That is not meant to belittle us. The whole point is that he calls us into thrones. He calls us higher than we would ever even allow ourselves. So when we have a problem with the thought that God is not saying he's equal to us, what are we trying to achieve? right? And I don't think that we're all, I don't think we're doing that. We might find ourselves having thoughts that may be like that, because there's a place where Jesus says, I don't call you servant, I call you friends. He draws us eye level to him, right? You are not in the back room, you're not doing the dishes, you're not cooking the food, you're sitting at the table with me. And I want to share my heart with you, and I want to hear your heart, and I want to share the most intimate things between us. But Jesus is not my equal. But in that picture, in meekness, where I recognize that, I get to sit in thrones. We get to sit in thrones. We're actually called to rule the world, right? I guess. Rule the earth. What do you think? Anything about that? We were called that the original call for Adam was a kingly calling. And it wasn't to rule with a heavy stick, but it was to be able to lead people in good things and in life, and to lead in authority. And oftentimes, if we lead in the authority that God calls us to, we have power and authority, and people won't know. So, in the mystery, that is where change begins and continues, in communion with Jesus. A revelation from God does not answer all our questions, but it does answer the question that draws us deeper into the mystery and unknowing. To commune with him, to surrender our lives to receive his life, to allow his nature to become our nature, we must let go of our need to understand all. It is in this place of intimacy, stillness, and quiet that we grow in trust with him, where his very presence assures us of his purpose and plans of love, plans to prosper us and not to harm us, plans to give us hope in a future. It is here that our being becomes one with his being. What are your thoughts you guys have? And I'm okay being challenged on any of it, you know? I mean,
I had a conversation with my wife a couple days ago. We were talking about how people pray differently when they are praying in front of other people. You just naturally, I don't know,
yeah,
for whatever reason, you don't. So I asked her the question, I said, when you pray privately, how do you start the prayer? And she said, she goes, I normally start it like, Dear God. And she goes, and I'm like, and I start off my prayers with, Okay, God.
You know, just, all right, God.
Okay, we're gonna talk about some things. But it's so random, because it never, in private, it never starts off with Our Heavenly Father, you know, it just doesn't start way.
It's way less formal, usually, right?
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that stuck out to me. And you're talking about intimacy with the Father. And I mean, when you pray privately, how do you start off your prayer? I mean, it took me a minute to even think of how I start off the prayer, because I just don't think, how do I?
Probably different at different times, you know? Maybe the heart space I'm in, you know?
Yeah, definitely.
I think sometimes it's Lord, you know? Yeah. And sometimes it's not the same. It's the same word, but sometimes it's desperate, Lord. Yeah. You know, or I don't know. Yeah, that's a good question. It'd be interesting to listen to myself when I do that.
Yeah.
Because,
The other thought I had towards the beginning of what you were talking about was, did you have something to say?
No,
I'm sorry.
No. I'm like thinking now.
I've heard it said that God is found in the personal possessive pronouns, which is like super whatever. But basically what they mean by that is you will be our God and we will be your people. And not a, you know, it's, if you were to overhear a conversation with somebody and they were say, you know, my Eleanor, my Theodore, my friend, it's a possessive, it's a possessing of that. You would immediately think there is a deep, intimate relationship if I were to overhear a conversation.
Totally.
Somebody said, my John. And so when you're talking about, you know, my Aaron, I am Jesus' Aaron,
yeah.
it's that coming into the idea of just greater intimacy
mm-hmm.
with that. He
yeah.
is not just a God, he is my God.
Yeah. I like that. That's cool. Mm-hmm. It's like ownership, not in like, it's like ownership of like my wife. This is my wife, Nikki.
Right.
It's not your wife. This is my wife, Nikki.
Right.
Right?
All
and I get all like crazy a little bit. What's that?
All I can think about is Borat. My wife.
My wife.
Don't react too much.
Well, you don't say, this is a wife, Nikki.
Right.
Who happens to be mine.
Yeah. Right. And so I think...
That's weird.
I think, you know, in talking about mysticism and living just more spiritual, I think we do it. I just don't think we realize that we are.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, definitely. Like, because, like, I know so many people, especially, like, in the American, like, Christian church, which is usually fairly conservative, you know?
Mm.
Like, the second you say mysticism, it's like, oh, well, that's from the East, and that's Satan in disguise. It's like, no, well, I mean, where did the religion start? Oh, the East? Okay, cool. Weird.
Yeah.
That we would have some form of mysticism involved in it. You know?
Yeah.
Like, but I think it's that word scares so many people.
Yeah.
I don't think there's anything to be afraid about with the word. It's, you know?
Yeah. I think that if we think about it and we say, I want to live that way. Because I think that there's, sometimes I find myself with these short seasons where I feel dry.
Yeah,
and I don't know why. And it's because I'm trying to connect with God through very rational means.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And he will remind me, and this is my story, everybody's got a different way of engaging God, and sometimes they're similar, but like it really, it does become a place where like he's just pick up your guitar.
Yeah.
Like, why are you trying to, you know what I mean? Right? It's like just sing a song with me. Or sing a song. Like or sing a song about something.
Mm-hmm.
Right? There's ways that where I get a look at and it's like, it kind of comes out in my songs, you know, where it's like, I recognize the life of God in the trees when the
yes.
wind blows through them, you know, but sometimes you step back and you feel so lonely and you feel so dry and you're like,
yeah.
why? Well, let's see. When's the last time I got quiet? When's the last time I listened? When's the last time I picked up my guitar? When's the last time I did the things to actually engage
mm-hmm.
deeper?
Yeah,
it's like one of those, we get so caught up in like, just like our everyday life, you know, that it almost becomes like a passive thing,
mm-hmm.
like,
yeah,
rather than like something that we're like seeking out. It's just kind of like, oh yeah, it's like a passive thing that I do, like when I think about it,
yeah,
you know. Rather than something that we're really like striving for. And I'm constantly having to do that too. Like, I was on my way to church today and I was like, oh dang, I haven't really prayed that much this week. Like I have,
yeah.
but I'm like, I should really do that. So then I got my W-2. You know, like.
Yeah, yeah. If, you know, there's, you know, and some people, when people can't relate, right, they haven't been in that space, and they have, and they hear things like, oh, I need to pray more.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got this real religious tinge
it
to it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
But, like, legitimately, like, sometimes that's what we need to do more.
Yeah.
Like, but if we get the moment to explain it to somebody who would hear us say that, but, I mean, who's hearing it right now? I mean, anybody, I guess, can hear it.
Yeah.
But... We might cut. I don't know. We'll see. But if you think about God in a religious confined structure,
right,
and you suck the life out of it, and you suck the relationship out of it, I need to pray more is about like basically whipping your back and yeah. getting scars on your knees.
It's a great thing. Right.
You know, and like when I say it, it's like, oh man, I want that relationship. Like I don't.
Yeah.
I want to just go through the motions because I feel like that's what I'm doing in life in general. Yeah. You know.
Yeah, I have two thoughts on that. One, how beautiful is it that in times when we feel dry, in times when we feel like, you know, I need more of God or I need more of something, so I'm going to go to God, that we can go to God. We can just pick up our guitar or we can just pray or we can get into the car and be like, okay, God. And we can get there, whereas like people who don't have that opportunity.
Yeah.
Just they, where do they run?
Yeah.
And the other thought I had is I spoke on joy this morning, and in Romans 15, Paul prays. He says, "May the God of hope give you joy," basically. And it struck me because in Romans, Paul prays a couple times in Romans. The first prayer is. I pray for you constantly that you will never lose faith.
Mm-hmm.
And they always seem so strange because the Church of Rome was one of the more persecuted churches. I mean, they were being hunted. And it's not, I pray for you constantly that Nero would get converted and stop hunting you guys, or that your lives would all of a sudden get better, that you would be given all these freedoms and rights. It was, I pray that you don't lose faith, and I pray that you have joy.
Mm. Yeah, he's not praying for them to leave the situation or their circumstances, but just
that in those circumstances,
yeah,
and in that situation, in those circumstances, that God will be ever present, and I think that, you know, in like being able to go to God whenever we need. I think that's a lot more important than just hoping our circumstances stay good. You know?
Right. It's, what is our purpose in praying?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do we need God, or we just need Him to fix something for us?
Right. Genie in the bottle.
Yeah. And sometimes we do need something specific from Him. You know what? Pray, you have not because you ask not.
Right.
So there's place for that, but it's always in relationship. In the name of Jesus means what? I stand in the person of Jesus when I declare this. I stand in union with God when I pray in the name of Jesus. It is not a incantation.
Right.
You know, like it is like, it's not reading a spell.
Right.
It's being in union with the living God when you pray.
Right.
Having the mind of Christ. And sometimes it's desperate. And sometimes it's, I need a new car, God. And sometimes it's, I need a friend. I mean, real life stuff.
Yeah.
But I love that because he's like, his purpose is not always to remove us. He's like, you are supposed to be the light in that place. Why would I take you from there?
Right.
I need you to shine where you're at. And I love, there's that, is it a Psalms, I think, where it talks about changing the valley of weeping into a valley of joy?
Yeah.
Right? A valley of rain. And what happens? We're transformed, and we get to be a part of transformation. But if we just all huddle together and don't take our transformation out to help transformation happen elsewhere or in the challenging places, the deserts, the fill in the blank, right? The valleys of weeping. If we don't go there, then the whole world gets to die while we are locked inside of some kind of weird utopia.
Yeah.
That's, Jesus is like, follow me, I'm going to the next town.
Yeah.
I think that there's both. I love that I was reading, you know, the Franciscan Richard Rohr, who I quoted at the beginning, is a Franciscan, right? And that I was reading about that, and about that the Franciscans, one very strong mode of thinking is that you live your way into new ways of thinking. And in the worldly wisdom, that conflicts with the idea that, like, who you are dictates your actions.
Right.
How can we say both? Godly wisdom is I get to hold two things that seem contradictory together, because he gives us great responsibility and then also says, like, but I am the one that enacts change. It's great. I don't know. It's just a relationship. That's what it is. It's a relationship.
Yeah.
We can't pray like, God, give me these things so I can do it without you.
Right. Yeah.
I really think it's hard for us to believe that we can be different. You know? I think that really is the heart of the gospel, is transformation.
Yeah.
And we overcomplicate things because that's what we're going to do. And the gospel is so much simpler. Um.